American Radio.
If you were the only boy in this world,
and you were the only girl.
Zsa Zsa Gabor once said, "A man in love is incomplete until he's married, and then he's finished." But in the golden days of American radio comedy, the opposite were true. The married double acts of the pre-war years proved that working with your wife was not only to be encouraged, it was a virtual necessity. Many of the married double acts of the time were urbane and sophisticated, but one duo were to remain true to the rural Midwest. Marion Jordan was Molly Magee, the reliable, level-headed and long-suffering wife who brought calm and reassurance not just to her braggart husband Fibber, but to the whole of America.
You mean you're going to talk on the radio?
Mm-hmm.
Heavenly days, isn't that exciting? Aren't you nervous?
Nah, nothing to it.
It was a heavenly day that Marion Driscoll was born, her husband Jim Jordan once proclaimed, and for her contribution to the world of comedy, there'd be very few who would disagree. It was April 15th, 1898, that the woman who was to become the mother to the nation was born to a coal miner and his family in the heart of rural Illinois. It was at a church choir practice that Marion and Jim first met. It was an instant attraction, and before long they were married. But within months, Jim found himself drafted, and in 1917 was posted to the front in France. America had not been prepared for President Wilson's declaration of war against Germany, and a national program of voluntary rationing was hastily introduced. There were wheatless Mondays, porkless Thursdays, and for motorists, gasless Sundays. Such was the fervour of hatred against anything remotely German that the country found itself caught up in a frenzy of patriotic hysteria. German measles was changed to Liberty measles, and hamburgers were renamed Liberty steaks. A soldier's chances of surviving active service in 1917 were negligible, but Jim was saved from the trenches by contracting a severe case of dysentery. It was so bad, in fact, that by the time he'd fully recovered, the war was over. He had failed to see combat, but he had used his time in France to future advantage by honing his performing skills as he entertained convalescing troops.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
On his return, Jim and Marion became determined to break into vaudeville and concentrated on working up a song and piano act which they performed in church halls. I asked Dr. Lucy Delap, research fellow at King's College, Cambridge, whether it was unusual for a married woman to go into vaudeville at that time.
I think the 20s was a period, though, of expanding visions, imaginations about what women could do. So it wouldn't have been completely out of the horizons of women to take that sort of career choice. But I would say for many it would have been not a career choice but a matter of economic necessity.
Money was tight, and Jim was forced to sell vacuum cleaners, insurance, washing machines and work as a labourer in order to keep the both of them afloat. Working in vaudeville, then, was clearly not supporting the family financially. So why did they persist? Here's Dr. Rob Lewis, lecturer in American Studies at Birmingham University.
Many people argue that they were paid very little in vaudeville, that they could have earned more by doing other jobs. But it's their fierce ambition which drove them on, because they hoped that someday, somewhere, they'd make it good.
And in 1922, the dream to make good was made real, when a prominent theatrical agent, Ralph Miller, found himself in Peoria on a talent scout. He saw Jim and Marion and signed them up for their first professional vaudeville tour. To talk about the Jordans, I met Jim and Marion's granddaughter, Janice Jordan.
The vaudeville that they ended up in was called the Chautauqua Circuit, which was the low end of vaudeville. Because I know that when they got into it, they basically just traveled by train from city to city, and they did tent shows and church basement shows, and they just went from one to another, and they were really poor even then. If they had been on one of the other circuits, like the Orpheum or the Pantages, those are the ones that paid really good money, but not Chautauqua. And they were struggling. until they stumbled into radio.
And stumble they did. Jim and Marion were in danger of becoming nothing more than a small-town act. But after hearing an average singer on a local radio broadcast, Jim's brother bet Jim $10 that he and Marion could do better. They took up the challenge, travelled to the WIBO station in Chicago, and auditioned. They were hired and started to appear daily, doing the song and piano act that they'd done on stage. Here's Rob Lewis again.
Those who were successful in radio comedy were ones ready who were young enough and ambitious enough and versatile enough to adapt. They were not set in their ways. Whereas some already established perhaps weren't prepared to learn new material or to adapt their ways to cope with the kind of demands that radio comedy would have had.
The fact that they were unsuccessful vaudevillians had worked to their advantage. It meant they were cheap, and radio stations were not yet in a position to be able to hire big names. Jim and Marion had quietly crept in, and with one foot in the door, they were determined to consolidate their position. Here's Janice again.
They had no idea what radio was. Nobody did, because it was right there as it was happening. If they had known what it was going to turn into, they never would have done it because they would have been too frightened because of how big it got and how big they got.
Comedy was where Jim and Marion's true talents lay, but up till that point, they'd been unable to come up with a suitable vehicle. It was around this time that the Jordans met Dawn Quinn, a gifted comedy writer who had come to Chicago in search of work. Together, they came up with a radio show called Smackout.
He was a cartoonist or an animator or something. You have to say he was the genius behind it, though. I mean, he created it. I don't know. I know that my grandfather just gave full credit to him, though.
In Smackout, Jim played the owner of a hardware store who was always smack out of everything. And Marion, who was discovering she had a talent for voice mimicry, played a host of different characters. Mrs. J. Hi-Hat Upson, the well-to-do madam. The widow Weedledeck, who was forever poking her nose into other people's business. And an incomprehensible little girl called Teeny, who lived across the road.
My daddy says you're one of the most open-minded men he ever knew.
Oh, he did, huh?
I'm sure. Oh. And he says it's a good thing, too, because if anybody's mind ever needed air and not, yours does.
Jim and Marion were starting to get noticed amongst the radio elite, but even though Smackout was doing well, it wasn't a resounding success, and the network was considering taking it off the air. But a flood of letters from the show's loyal fans persuaded the network that they were wrong. One of those fans, Henrietta Johnson Lewis, was to turn the Jordans' fortunes around completely. She was the daughter of the head of the Johnson Wax Company and the wife of a partner at a top advertising agency. Her insistence that her husband and father listen to Smackout led to Johnson Wax deciding to sponsor a new show starring the talents of Jim and Marion Jordan. That show was to be Fibber McGee and Molly.
The Johnson Wax Program with Fibber McGee and Molly.
Jim played Fibber, the ridiculous braggart who was always boasting about things he hadn't done or wasn't actually able to do.
Circuses don't thrill me anymore. I traveled with one once, you know.
You did, Johnny? What doing?
Remember that act where the guy rides the bicycle across the tight wire, 65 feet in the air, with a beautiful gal on each shoulder?
Wowie, was that you, Johnny?
No, but it was my bicycle.
But Fibber McGee was more than just a teller of tales for the American public. The Depression years had brought many men to their knees. Here's Dr. Mary Elise Surratt, lecturer in politics and fellow of St. John's College, Cambridge, to explain.
Black Tuesday was October 24th, 1929. And if you had invested money at the beginning of 1929, between October 24th and October 29th, you lost all of your profits. So your whole year's profits were wiped out in 5 days. By November, all of your profits from 1928 were gone. By the early 1930, all of your profits from 1927 are gone. And the economy hit bottom in June of 1932 when it squeezed to half its size. You have to imagine this. The Dow was down 50%, unemployment at 25%, 12 million people out of a national population of 123 million unemployed. I mean, it's almost unthinkable.
For Americans, it was a time when bankruptcy, unemployment and poverty were rife, and many couldn't escape feelings of personal inadequacy and shame. For the listeners at home, Fibber was someone they could readily identify with. Here's Lucy Delap.
Well, clearly you had a redefinition of masculinity. You had a problematic confinement of men within the home and a recognition of their inability to openly take on household tasks, and yet they had to. Therefore, you do have men reluctantly taking on household tasks, and curiously, you have women either staying in the labour market or going back to the labour market unexpectedly when perhaps they hadn't wanted to, because their husbands find it harder to get work than the women do. So even though you've got a very elaborate and established campaign saying to women, don't steal men's jobs, and you've got bars on married women working, you do have quite extensive participation in the labour market from women.
Fibber's constant daydreaming and bungling contrasted with the absolute level-headedness of Molly. She was the constant voice of reason at their fictional home at 79 Wistful Vista and was often called upon to referee arguments between Fibber and their visitors. She was warm and friendly, and most importantly, she had the patience of a saint.
McGee, wake up. McGee, wake up.
What? What's the matter?
Nothing's the matter. It's time to get up, dear.
Huh?
I say it's time to get up. Come on now.
It can't be. It's still dark. Can't see a thing.
You could if you'd open your eyes.
Huh? Oh!
The character of Molly was indispensable to the show's success. When Marin had to leave the show for a year due to illness, the ratings slumped.
Women were seen as the glue that was binding the whole lot together, and men couldn't supply that role as the breadwinner, so it was an extremely problematic period for men. And thus you did have quite a lot of reactionary conservative ideology which tried to promote men's role as the head of the household, even though really the popular resonance was with women as the centre of the family holding it all together.
At first, the show had Fibber and Molly as tourists travelling around in an old bust-up jalopy. The reason for this was that Johnson Wax wanted to promote their new range of car wax, but by the end of 1935, the requirements of the sponsor had shifted. They had a new product, floor wax. Fibber and Molly were going to have to stay at home.
McGee, I thought you were going to work on the furnace.
I am. I'm just getting set for it.
Does working crossword puzzles put you in the mood for it or something?
Why, certainly. Sharpens the wits, steadies the nerves, stimulates the ingenuity. Whenever I have a big job of work to do, I always start with a few crossword puzzles. Got to develop my mind along with my muscles, you know.
Well, the way you sit around on your muscles all day, you'll wind up very broad-minded. I fixed that up.
Yes, sir.
Say, after you change the furnace so it'll burn coal again, you might weather strip the doors and windows too, dearie. The tighter the house is, the less fuel we'll have to burn.
Ah, the windows fit tight enough.
No, they don't. Our dining room windows have a draft that would take married men with 7 children.
The show dedicated itself to a favourable reassessment of small-town life. It was a backlash against the Depression, when people had begun to reject urban life for more simple community living. It was a show that worked to uphold the national morale. Dr. Mary Elise Surratt.
The suffering was fairly well spread among both urban and agricultural centres. We tend to see the spectacular photos of Wall Street, people jumping out of windows, but the agricultural centre was very hard hit as well. There was an extraordinarily bad winter, 1932-1933, a bank failure in early 1933. As a matter of fact, the bank failure happened the day that Roosevelt was inaugurated, the 4th of March, 1933. And events like that don't just hurt cities, they hurt agricultural sectors as well.
During the Depression, Fibber McGee and Molly reaffirmed the country's traditional values and institutions.
Incidentally, where are you going on your vacation?
Well, we haven't decided, Mr. Wilcox, what with saving tires and gas and cutting down on pleasure driving. We probably won't be doing anything very fancy.
Hey, I got a great idea, Molly. What say we take a long walking trip?
Walking trip?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
No.
I thought...
Don Quinn was indisputably one of radio's greatest comedy writers, and as well as breathing life into Fibber and Molly, he invented a whole host of characters who were constant visitors to 79 Wistful Vista. But one of the most popular parts of the show was Fibber's incredible alliterative outbursts.
Get that dope, McGee, the dashing, daring darling of the dailies and the ding-dong, dipsy-doodle-daddy of the dirt dishers, diligently deviling dignified diplomats for delicate details, discreetly dictating data difficult to decipher, and deliberately denouncing dangerous demagogues dripping with dubious dialogue designed to develop defeatism, doing my duty with a dearth of dilly-dallying, despite the dirty digs of the desperate dogs who determined to dampen my do-or-die disposition and deteriorate a diggity-dynamo into a drippy droop, a dandy detective at dodging and death and danger, but doesn't this description sound like a total stranger?
Jim and Marion were riding high, and as they were both entering their 40s, success was finally theirs.
Picture this. These two people from this little tiny place, and all of a sudden they're like the number one show in the United States with people stopping everything on the night that they're on to listen to them. I mean, they were so big.
One thing was certain. As well as enjoying enormous public popularity, their private lives were incredibly happy. They were devoted to each other, and at the end of every broadcast would clasp each other's hand tightly. Jim once said,
"Radio made us homebodies. When you're in radio, the best things in life are yours for the choosing. You can work out a normal, regular life and fill it with exactly the things you want and still have time to raise a family and enjoy them, too. In Hollywood, it seems as if two people no sooner get married than the studios separate them."
To which Marion added,
"We won't let them separate us. They've tried plenty of times, but neither one of us wanted to try to work with anyone else. We've always been a team. We've always worked together and always will. That's our strength and our stock in trade. We've refused some fine-sounding offers in order to stick together."
But despite their mistrust of Hollywood, they did finally accept the call in 1937, but it was on their terms. They'd be working together in a romantic comedy, This Way Please.
I think that they were more comfortable on the radio than they were in front of a camera. Because I know that when Grandpa was in his 70s, he did one episode of Chico and the Man, and he was a wreck. He was a nervous wreck. He was great, though. But, you know, it wasn't his element. It wasn't their element.
But success was to take its toll. When This Way Please premiered in Chicago, Marion was too ill to attend. She was suffering from a total physical breakdown. The relentless treadmill of the radio show and her film commitments was proving too much for her, and a recent miscarriage had left her feeling desperately low.
She had a complete nervous breakdown. She was suicidal. As a matter of fact, if you've read the book, you know that you've seen the picture of my father and my grandmother standing in front of the plane. She tried to kill herself on the plane with my father, the one who was taking care of her, this little 13-year-old kid. And she had to be institutionalized, and she was catatonic. And I know that every episode, or every show, at the end of the show, you know, Grandpa would say goodnight to her. And isn't it interesting, too, that nowadays, what do you think would happen now if somebody had something like that happen to them? They'd be all over it, you know? But people were protected back then, which was kind of a nice thing in a way. Anyway, so she was really, really ill. And I know my dad told me that she was one of the first, if not the first woman in the United States to have shock treatment. And then she came back.
Marion was unable to return to work until almost 2 years later in 1939. Marion's breakdown was kept a secret from the public, and it isn't difficult to understand why. Mental breakdowns were a taboo subject in the 1930s, and news of a suicide attempt would have been extremely damaging to her career. But another reason was that the public's perception of Marion was inextricably linked with that of Molly, and to the public it would have been inconceivable that Molly McGee, a stalwart of strength and determination, was unable to cope.
She was a human being just like everybody else, and you know, and that's another thing about creative people. Oftentimes they're just very fragile, you know, and there were a lot of pressures. That was a huge job to do every week.
With Marion back in situ, the show's ratings, which had slumped during her absence, rose once more. But Marion wasn't to know just how important her role as wife and mother was about to become. Japan had attacked Pearl Harbor, and America was at war.
Well, I just wanted to say to you other housewives and you men who sit in the living room and read the paper while we girls do the dishes, that if we put our minds to it, we can strangle a post-war depression with our own apron strings.
Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Can't afford to sit.
get around the wishing. Praise the Lord, we'll blast them to perdition if you're ready.
Aye.
Aim, fire!
By the end of 1942, Fibber, McGee and Molly had become the most listened to programme, with over 30 million Americans tuning in on a regular basis. It was a year that was also to mark their return to film in the RKO picture Here We Go Again. Despite doing well at the box office, one reviewer rather snidely commented that
their homespun sallies might sound amusing in the kitchen or on a rural front porch, but not in a movie theatre. None of the radio stars are as funny on the screen as they are over the air.
But it was those homespun sallies that were to make Jim and Marion so crucial throughout the war years, and they were awarded with a special citation on June 19th, 1945. It read,
to the beloved Fibber, McGee and Molly of America's Millions, in recognition of their successful efforts to lighten the burden of the American people in a time of great ordeal through understanding and clean comedy, and in acknowledgement of their accomplishment of portraying the American home through gentle humor, in true dignity, as a great source of our national strength.
And they were honored again in 1948 by the National Federation of Catholic Colleges, who honored them for, amongst other things,
the high ideals of which they give evidence in their public life as well as in their private kingdom.
The Jordans were, it seems, perceived as the upholders of a truly righteous way of life. Here's author Gary Poole.
Well, they were a very strong moral couple, and she was the rock of the family. She kept him in check, and they didn't stand for any hanky-panky or sexual innuendos or anything like that. They were just Mr. and Mrs. United States, and that was their appeal, that they stood for a good, strong family life.
In 1949, the Jordan sponsor, Johnson Wax, was keen to start advertising on the new medium of television and began persuading Jim and Marion that Fibber needed to make the leap. But the Jordans were difficult to convince. Many of Fibber's jokes depended on the audience's imagination, the running hall cupboard joke.
Where's my hat?
Right in there.
Thanks. Didn't I ever straighten out that closet?
And the fact that 79 Wistful Vista was, in Jim's words, anywhere, Middle America, USA. The Jordans were reluctant, but they did finally make a television pilot, although their discomfort with the new art form is clearly evident in the fact that rather than film Fibber as a TV sitcom, they filmed it as a radio show, with everyone standing in front of microphones and with audience laughter played in. It looked awkward and outdated and was not a success. And then, in May 1950, the unthinkable happened. The Jordans lost their sponsor. It was also to be a parting of the ways with Don Quinn, the writer on whom they had come to depend. It was a difficult time.
I don't know if they were looked the part or whatever, or were not visual actors. They were strictly radio performers. They could do a lot with their voices, but visually they were kind of stiff.
Fibber continued on radio for another two seasons, each one with different sponsors, but by 1953 things were to change drastically. With television blooming, sponsors were increasingly disinterested in radio, and by the time the Jordans returned to the air in October of that year, they found that their budget had been drastically cut. The once-a-week, half-hour format had now become 15 minutes five times a week, and the studio audience that they so relied on during performances were gone, as were most of the supporting cast. But it came as something of a relief. Marion's health was failing again, and the new format meant they could pre-record the shows on one day, thus giving her the rest of the week off.
Well, you know, maybe they were getting tired, because by the 1950s, they were in their 50s, and that was already a long haul. I mean, maybe it was time to just slow down a little bit and enjoy life a little bit, because other than that, their life was all around, you know, centered around the show, which was work. Work, 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 work. They'd been working really hard for a really long time, since they were in vaudeville. They never stopped.
So fragile was she, in fact, that in 1959, when NBC decided they wanted to finally give Fibber a run on television, the Jordans refused to be in it. So the televised version of Fibber, McGee and Molly went ahead, but with different actors in the lead roles. But the American public knew and loved Fibber and his steadfast wife as Jim and Marion Jordan, and many found their replacements a bitter pill to swallow.
Because it wasn't them. I mean, there couldn't be any other reason. And, you know, the actors weren't bad. Those were good actors, but they weren't Fibber and Molly. So, you know, it's like, could you have done Burns and Allen without Burns and Allen? I don't think so.
The series was cancelled after 26 weeks and was never to be resurrected. Marion's health was increasingly deteriorating, and in 1960 she was diagnosed as having ovarian cancer. Jim cancelled all his work commitments, and the pair spent the rest of that year together at home, where Jim made things in his workshop and Marion, when she felt up to it, made herself useful in the garden. On April 6, 1961, Marion complained of severe pains. Jim gathered her family around her, and half an hour later, she died.
It was a terrible blow. I remember him walking around going, I've lost half my life. But he did remarry. And he lived another 26, 27 years, and he was happily married. He traveled a lot, and he went on to enjoy the rest of his life. But he really, really loved my grandmother, really loved her.
The contribution that Jim and Marion made to the morale of the American nation was inestimable, and is almost impossible to imagine being replicated today. Their popularity was immense.
I guess it would be as if Friends, Frasier, The Simpsons, and Sex and the City were all one show. And that would give you an idea as to how many people tuned in to listen to them week after week after week for over 30 years.
A cover of an album of Fibber recordings in 1945 sums up the esteem in which they were held.
Fibber McGee and Molly have become an American institution. More than a great comedy team, they reflect the hopes and ambitions as well as the daily tribulations of the American people. Never before in this great nation's history has there been a more popular, more beloved couple.
I just think they had a lot of serendipity, too. They were the right couple, they hooked up with the right writer, and they meshed or something. And they had the perseverance to just keep doing it. It's just totally amazing to me that they were on that long. When you look at the way